All righty, time once again for the truth about markets at 104.4 Residence in London. Stacey, how's it going?
Max is going pretty well.
Oh, great. So I guess we should talk about Germany. It's very interesting because the leader over there, Angela Merkel,
yep.
She's been very vocal about the naked short sellers and trying to drive them out of her country. And there's some legislation in America to try to rein in the financial leveraged speculators. So anyway, what all happened in Germany? There, at one moment there, it looked like the whole European Union was going to be flushed down the derivatives toilet.
What do you mean? The Euro area was going to collapse?
Yeah, remember back then, I think it was Thursday. There was an idea, remember? Everyone went to bed on Thursday, or was it Wednesday, thinking they were going to wake up and that Europe was going to have declared bankruptcy. Remember? And
the euro was
down. It was down. Euro was down 122 or so against the dollar. Don't you remember? Everyone's got amnesia. You know,
no,
there was a moment
there. There's so many days. Every single day is a wild swing to the other side. So, yeah, the euro got down to, I think, just under 122. And then it flung back up to like 127 the next day. And then down again to 123 or something. So there's been wild swings and everything in the past week since Angela Merkel did ban naked short selling. And of course, the bankers and their entire financial press who were speaking on their behalf were warning of Armageddon as a result of this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, explain to the audience, though, the difference between short selling and naked short selling.
That'd be my pleasure.
No, you don't get naked, honey. Put your clothes back on. Well, okay. First, explain short selling.
Yeah. Well, short selling is like selling, you see. It's just like selling, except you're selling something that you don't own. You're selling something that you borrowed.
So okay.
You borrow some stock and you sell it.
Okay, and why would you do that? You would borrow, say you borrow British Airways some shares in British Airways.
Yeah.
Why would you borrow it in order to sell it?
Well, you're hoping to return the shares that you borrowed after buying it back at a lower price.
So you do that because you think the price will fall. If BA is trading at 100 pence and you think it's going to 50 pence, then you borrow it at 100 and lend it out to somebody else at 100,
mm-hmm.
and then hope to buy it back at 50.
That's right. You hope to buy it back at 50. So the amount of money it takes to buy back what you borrowed is less than the cash you collected when you sold it to begin with. So you return the shares that you borrowed, and you get to keep the money, the difference between the two prices is yours to keep as a profit. Now, when you sell stock short, it's done in a margin account, or you know, which is the same as to say that you're borrowing. You see, you're borrowing stock. That's the key word there, borrow. So when you borrow something, you are charged a rate of interest. You see, and that is the margin rate or interest rate. So you can't really sell short in anything but a margin account or a margin in borrowing those shares, because that is the definition of what a short sale is to begin with. So you have this activity going on in what is by definition a leveraged account, because you're borrowing, and when you're borrowing, that's the leverage, isn't it? Now, the question is, if you're allowed to sell short, that is to say borrow stock and sell it, is this creating a negative bias in that stock? Like you mentioned British Airways, right? If people are allowed to sell that stock short in a margin account and with the idea that they're going to profit on the price decline, if a whole lot of people want to do that, can you create a negative bias and can you manipulate the share price down? Well, the first part of the answer is that on the other side of the trade are leveraged buyers of that stock, you see. You can buy a stock for cash, but you can also buy stock in a margin account. So you can buy stock as a leveraged purchase in a margin account. And this is works out to be roughly equivalent in the market in terms of supply and demand. The leveraged buyers and the leveraged short sellers are equally balanced for the most part in the whole, you know, price discovery mechanism. And you have a fair and orderly market as a result. And
in fact, short sellers, people who are betting against or betting the price will be going down, they provide liquidity to it?
Well, if there was no short selling, you would have an upward bias. In other words, stocks would just drift higher. It would have a very unbalanced upward bias if there was no short selling. If the only sellers that emerged in the marketplace were people who had bought first, that would definitely provide an upward bias, and that would not contribute to equilibrium in the market. So short selling gives us equilibrium. It's very necessary. It's key to the whole concept of exchange traded stocks, and it's been around since the stock markets were first introduced in Stockholm back in the 1600s.
In Amsterdam
back in the 1600s. So it's nothing new. It's very important. It's very essential. Now let's talk about naked short selling.
And this is what Angela Merkel banned. And the first immediate reports from the likes of Reuters, their headlines read that she banned short selling, which you just described. But in fact, she hasn't banned short selling.
No.
She's banned naked short selling in the 10 biggest German financial institutions, just naked short selling. You could still short those shares.
Yeah.
And she's also banned naked short selling of European Eurozone bonds and collateralized debt swaps.
Okay.
So tell us what is naked short selling.
All right. So let's talk about BP for a second, because you brought that up, right? Or was it British Air?
BA.
So British Airlines, let's say that the company has issued roughly, let's say it's issued 100 million shares. This is the capitalization of the company. They had an initial public offering many years ago, and since that time, they've had secondary offerings, and they sell stock in the company. People buy that stock. They now have a percentage equity interest in the company. If the company does well, the stock goes up. If the company does bad, the stock goes down. It's different than selling a bond, because you don't really participate in the profits and losses of the company. You get a fixed rate of interest, and that's another way to finance a company. You put those two things together, and you have the total market capitalization of a corporation. But we're not talking about bonds here. We're talking about stocks. We're saying that in the case of British Air, if they've issued 100 million shares of stock, I don't know what the exact number is, but just using this as an example, there are 100 million shares of stock, and a lot of that stock is in the hands of institutions. A lot of that stock is in the hands of individuals, and a lot of that stock is in the hands of the company itself. If you add all that stock up, you have 100 million shares of stock. That's how many shares have been issued. That's how many shares exist. That's the total number of shares in the float of British Aerospace. Now, a naked short seller will come into the market, and they'll sell 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, 10 million shares of British Aerospace.
British Air.
They'll sell, let's say, 1 million shares of British Air, but this is stock that's not officially on anyone's books. It's not part of the market capitalization of the company. It didn't come from an institution or a shareholder or the company itself. They simply sent to the floor of the exchange an order to sell 1 million shares of BA stock at the market. And they basically, there is no stock in existence. This is a naked short sale. There's no stock. They're just selling. This is why it's important to understand this is equivalent to counterfeiting. They're simply selling stock that they themselves just printed up effectively by selling on the exchange. Now, the specialist mechanism, the actual ability to create a price based on the supply of buys and sells, it cannot differentiate between somebody throwing 1 million shares of counterfeit stock in through a naked short sale and somebody legitimately selling stock. or somebody selling stock short. So those are the three types of sell orders. Each one has the ability to influence the share price lower. Two of those are legitimate, a cash sale and a short sale. One of them is illegitimate, a naked short sale. Now, Angela Merkel rightfully has called out the speculators for attacking the price with counterfeit stock sales, which is driving the price lower. The speculators can make money on the lower price in the same way they can make money with a short sale, and they can leverage those returns by making bets in the options market and other derivatives markets. It's a guaranteed profit. They're not taking any risk. It's counterfeiting, just like if I went to the store and gave them a counterfeit 50-euro note, I made 50 euros. I mean, I've got 50 euros. I buy a stick of gum for 10 cents, and they give me 49 euros and 90 cents back in cash. I made 49 euros and 90 cents on my counterfeit 50-euro note.
Well, and so with the situation is that, as Jim Rogers said on a recent Kaiser report, that if you don't deliver, however, if you're short selling in the cash market and then it's a naked short, if you fail to deliver, then you go to prison, as he says. But there are two different ways to get around that. One is you drive the entire company out of business, as it was the case with Lehman Brothers,
right?
Where, you know, as Matt Taibbi pointed out in his reporting, there were like many, many times more than the outstanding shares shorted.
That's right.
So obviously that was naked short selling. Those people, had the company survived, many people would have been unable to deliver those shares at the end of the day.
That's right.
And the other thing, as we have in our next Kaiser report, yet to air at this time, as you're hearing this, is that the guy from Stifel Nicolaus, the CEO, says that most of this naked short selling happens in the derivatives market, not in the cash market.
Mm-hmm.
So explain what that means.
Well, just to reiterate on the Lehman Brothers thing. So in other words, somebody sells 20 million shares of Lehman Brothers that doesn't exist. You know, when you sell something, you keep the proceeds. So they keep the cash. They sold 20 million shares at $20 a share. And then the company goes to zero and they go out of business and they never have to buy the shares back to return the shares because their company has gone out of existence. So they just keep the cash. I mean, it's exactly the same as somebody using their Visa card, running $1 million up on the Visa card, and then Visa goes out of business and they say, well, they're out of business, so I have nobody to reconcile my claim with, so I'm going to just keep the money. And except that in this case, of course, the people drove Lehman out of business so that they would never have to reconcile these trades. Number two, the whole process of delivering stock is a whole function of Wall Street. There's this whole separate part of the Wall Street plumbing that's in charge exclusively on delivering stock in this way, clearing these trades. And the people who naked short sell game the system because they know that this particular area of the street is way behind and unable to track stock. There are something like 60, 70 million shares sold short that are waiting to be cleared, and that clearing can take up to a year or more. This was the whole story with Overstock.com, where the chairman and the CEO alerted regulators that his company was being driven to zero by naked short sellers. And the whole process of clearing these short sales through the agency that keeps track of this stuff was exposed as being completely inadequate to the task. And if, in fact, all these trades were cleared every single day, you wouldn't have naked short selling because people would have to deliver at the end of the day or within a settlement date, let's say 3 days, and you wouldn't have this problem would not have metastasized into this gargantuan, cancerous threat to the economy. But because it takes months, if not more than a year, you have this incredible room to game the system. Now, as far as cash versus derivatives, what he's talking about in the derivatives market is basically the same problem we have with all derivatives markets. That is to say that The ability to securitize and resecuritize and resecuritize again the basic underlying securities in newfangled packages, whether it's a credit default swap or a collateralized debt obligation, is just goes on ad infinitum. And every time somebody comes around to pick up the and collect the actual money, they simply say, well, we re-securitized in a new vehicle and we have to restart the clock and we won't deliver until that's necessary. And then they just never, ever deliver. And securities and derivatives just are a way to make it much easier to perpetuate the same underlying fraud, which is to counterfeit. It's a derivatives counterfeiting is easier than cash counterfeiting. You still have cash counterfeiting in the cash market, and that's still a problem. And there is a mechanism in place to keep track of it. It's just inadequate to the task, and you have the situation with Overstock.com. In the derivatives market, there is not even any regulatory authority clearing these trades at all, and you just have a rampant uncollateralized counterfeiting going really ad infinitum. And you know, Jim Rogers' point, basically, as I understood it, was as long as we don't get caught, it's legal. I mean, that's his standard for behavior, is not getting caught, which I think in a civilized society doesn't really work.
Can you say, actually, speaking of naked shorts, you've asked, you know, where is the naked long? So mm-hmm. to create a balance, to create a market, you need the opposite trade, right?
That's right.
Could you say that the entire subprime CDO market was naked long? Because many people thought they owned the contracts on those mortgages, but they didn't. Or was it a naked short?
Well, to the people who are being asked to leave their homes because they're behind on their mortgages, and when they say, where's the paper that connects me to this mortgage, they're right, and they should simply say that they're speculating in the naked long market.
Mm-hmm.
They're naked long traders. They have an imaginary mortgage piece of paper, and they're trading it on the imaginary naked long exchange. Now, why can't people participate equally with everyone else? This is where I've gotten back into this whole idea of Jim Crow laws that exist in the credit markets. You know, if you're Goldman Sachs, your cost of credit is near zero. If you're not in Goldman Sachs, you know, cartel, your cost of credit is 20%, 25%, 30%. These are basically Jim Crow laws in the interest rate spread between the white people and everybody else, and they have to suffer discrimination because they're not part of Goldman Sachs. Who's never
the white shoe firms versus everybody else.
Yeah, the white shoe firms. If you're not part of Goldman, you're being discriminated against in the credit markets. You're paying 25% for your money, and your rate of return in the stock market or in the cash market is near zero. If you're Goldman Sachs, your cost of credit is near zero, and your riskless rate of return using various arbitrage techniques and collateralized securities and various other short selling and naked longs is 17%. So it's the complete opposite. Your riskless rate of return is 17%, your cost of capital is zero. For everybody else, their cost of capital is 17% and their rate of return is zero. You see what I'm saying?
That's good. So,
okay, another naked long would be this. If you say that I imagine I own a bag of apples and the price of apples is going up, and I'm going to sell my imaginary bag of apples, and I make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the same as a naked short sale. Why can't anyone make naked long buys and say I'm trading and buying and selling imaginary apples? But in fact, you know, the irony is, as the news keeps trickling out, we are actually engaging in a market of naked longs. And I just saw a story out that the biggest player in the virtual currency market, Zynga, I think it's called.
Yeah.
They're giving away Farmville dollars as a promotion for people shopping for vegetables out there in the supermarket. So if you buy a bag of zucchinis at the supermarket, you get Farmville dollars, which is a virtual currency, which you can then use in Farmville, which is part of Facebook, to grow virtual vegetables. And those virtual vegetables trade on the Zynga virtual cash exchange for hard U.S. dollars. So that is a naked long.
So virtual vegetables may be soon more expensive than real vegetables.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, you could have virtual vegetables outpacing real vegetables as the virtual dollars become more valuable than the currently worthless fiat dollars. So the spread between naked longs and naked shorts is enormous. So a naked short sale of a credit derivative makes Goldman Sachs billions, whereas a naked long on Farmville's virtual currency market might make somebody $2. But it's the same, exact same value in the overall economy. The naked credit default swap is worth roughly the $2 in ink it was used to write a lot of nonsense on a piece of paper. And the naked long virtual Farmville currency on Farmville and Zynga is worth the $2 that you convert to hard money after you spent about 20 hours viewing ads on Facebook. So why is the naked long crowd getting $2 for spending 20 hours viewing ads, and the naked short people at Goldman are getting $2 billion for just the privilege of manufacturing bogus fiat virtual nonsensical credit default nonsense? Why? Because, oh, that's right, they're hooked into the federal government.
You know, here's another possible naked long I was thinking of while you were speaking there, and that is about $500 to $600 million worth of art was stolen from a museum here in Paris this past week. And can you consider that a naked long? That the guy, if the guy gets caught, his defense could say he was just naked long it.
Uh-huh. They have...
He didn't own it, but he sold it. So therefore, he had to deliver.
Yeah. He had sold it before he... why couldn't he simply have sold it and never actually stolen it? And then kept the profits from the implication that he was going to steal it. That would be a naked long.
Oh, somebody has naked long sold the Eiffel Tower, the Brooklyn Bridge.
Well, the Eiffel Tower, somebody sold the rights to dismantle it.
Okay.
And to for scrap, that they didn't have the rights to do it. That would be a naked short sale.
Okay.
In the case of this art thieving, this would be a naked long if, in fact, they sold the art that they had not yet stolen.
Uh-huh.
And they sold it for a profit based on the act of thieving that they had yet committed. Now, again, why do you have to actually go into the museum and steal the art if you can simply sell your naked long for a profit on a naked long exchange? Right along Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, who are selling naked shorts. They're both equally, they have an equal purpose in the economy, and they have equal weight in the economy. They have an intrinsic collateral value of zero, and they should both be allowed, not just one.
And you also see that difference between, in a real open market, that artwork is worth $500 to $600 million. But in this closed derivatives market of thieves, the guy would maybe make what, $5-10 million for it.
Well,
because he's just extracting they're extracting that much for one guy from this something that would be worth more in the open market.
Well, it reminds me of a scandal that goes back to, I think it was either Sotheby's or the other one, Christie's. They were involved in a scandal back in the 80s, I believe, where they were lending to Japanese speculators money to bid up the prices of Van Goghs. And when the Van Gogh prices were at those astronomical levels, I think it was in the 80s when it first breached 100 million or whatever, it turned out later that actually the auction house was lending the money to the speculator as a way to increase the value of all their artwork that they have in their catalog, which of course it was a publicly traded company. It must have been Sotheby's. So the value, the price of their stock goes up because the price of their inventory goes up based on these loans. And, of course, the executive have options on the stock price that are leveraged bets on the stock price. And they can cash out their options based on the higher stock price based on the bogus loans made to speculators who are driving up the price of Van Gogh's. So they, once again, were able to, that would be a naked long where they are speculating in the value of the art speculation on the way up and cashing out options based on a laddering of debt and a Ponzi scheme, if you will, and cashing in. And then they were exposed and there was a big fine to pay, but nobody went to jail, even though it's, you know, obviously a pretty ugly crime. Now, as far as just you're saying that the stealing the art in the closed art app secondary market of thieves, you have to mark it to, if you go to a fence, the value drops by a considerable amount than the stated value. This is basically a scam between the insurance companies and the museums and the thieves, similar to the scam you see with the rating agencies and the Wall Street thieves. They rate a package of naked long bogus securities, AAA, because within the package they put in AAA-rated U.S. government bonds in a process that I refer to as reverse drug dealing, where they actually add AAA-rated to the baby powder laxative to make it worth something, as opposed to the other form of drug dealing, where you need to add the baby laxative to the cocaine to expand the volume of what it is you're selling. So it's a reverse of that whole process. And insurance companies and the thieves and the museums work together to falsely appraise the value to help move the stolen goods on into the fences, who then distribute it to private buyers, and there's a markup on the other end as well. So the insurance companies, of course, are complicit in all these art thieves. If you were to go into this art thieving story, if you were to dig deeper, you would find that the insurance companies were involved to some degree, and the appraisers as well. The same way the appraisers were involved in the false housing market in the U.S. You know, the subprime mortgage market got legs, and the appraisers came up with new appraisals. This was the same story in London. They marked up the value of these homes by 20, 30, 40, 50% as a way to manipulate the market, and they were complicit in that.
Well, I'm going to tell a little story here about a true story about appraisers and these art houses and how you can make junk worth, get somebody to pay tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands for it. And I'll just briefly summarize this. I won't say any names because they're all well known, but a friend of mine was at a going away party, but a house sale party. One friend was selling, her family was selling their house, or their apartment on Fifth Avenue in New York. And they had all these Matisses and Picassos and stuff like that. And they had them all separated into various boxes, each labeled with a different color label, because they had a couple of houses around America, and they were sending some of the art to those various houses. And some of the art works were going on sale at an auction in New York City. Now, one of my friends, this is a guy who's well known, he went outside to get like a hamburger, went somewhere else to get something to eat. And he and a friend were walking back, and they saw a rail girder, you know, a piece of a railroad on the side of the road, on the sidewalk, as like junk. They were doing some work on the New York subway. So he thought it would be funny to put it into one of the boxes. So he brought this rail girder up and put it in one of the boxes. Mm-hmm. And that box ended up going to the auction house. And it was sold at auction along with all these Picassos and Matisses for tens of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. Just because it was a well-known family that had actually some connection to the rail system in America, the early rail system. And it was sold for tens of thousands of dollars as part of Americana.
Right. Well, Duchamp, of course, in Paris, sold the urinal as part of his auction. You know, this is part of the Surrealist movement in France, and Salvador Dali and Duchamp and these other artists too. There's another case of an artist selling Mère d'Artiste, where was vacuum packed his own feces into tin cans and sold those for quite a bit of money. So. And of course, Andy Warhol put the final coup de grace on this collaborative between commerce and art with his soup can silk screens, which were a study on the mundane that turned into multi-million dollar tableaus of artistic merit. And the price of Andy Warhol is just hitting new post-mortem highs. He continues to sell extremely well at auction. And so, again, you know, there's whole thin membrane between commerce and art and hype and reality and the utility value of the human psyche as it's played out in the interactions that constitute what we call the economy is ever surprising and ever mutating and ever evolving. And so this is why it's very difficult to take anyone seriously who espouses some ironclad rules of economic theory. theory as the single only way to conduct an economy. They're always going to be changing in real time as part of the feedback mechanism that you would see, let's say, in physics in Mandelbrot's set, or as George Soros would describe it, the theory of reflexivity. So the new prices change reality, which create new prices. And you see this in art and commerce and everything in between.
That's right. Well, here's another, somebody noted that it's another oracle prediction coming true. Simon Sharma, the well-known historian here in Britain, he has written a piece for the Financial Times, or he was interviewed in the Financial Times. And the question is, are the guillotines being sharpened? He's likening he's basically saying the situation right now is far more precarious than any politicians understand or realize. As somebody who's done research and studies and written about the French Revolution, he's saying that there's very little shared pain, and all he's seeing with all these European austerity measures are normal people sharing the pain.
Yeah.
And there's very little perceived justice about the very wealthy and the bankers in particular, who are collecting record bonuses at the very time that austerity measures are being imposed on normal people. And it doesn't matter, even if it is just according to their own, you know, rules of justice. It's the perception, and the perception, he's saying, is getting very dangerous, that they're the ones being asked to pay the cost of these big crimes.
Right. Well, you know, the history of the French Revolution, it's interesting. You had a volcano in Iceland that contributed to crop failure, which contributed to the French government starting to collateralize their own currency with mortgages, the assignats, a form of currency that was developed by, I think, Necker, which was the finance director at the time. I'd have to check my notes on that. And because they lent so much money to America to fund the Revolutionary War, they couldn't pay off these debts, and the people had no food to eat as a result of the crop failure and no money to buy anything, and you had the French Revolution. And the famous "let them eat cake" quote from Marie Antoinette. And in that spirit, in the approaching Bastille Day of July 14th, the date celebrated for the French Revolution, I was actually talking to the folks over there at the Sugar Plum Cake Shop this morning, only a few blocks from where we do this show in Paris. And I have commissioned a cake guillotine. I've commissioned a guillotine made of cake. Now, for the first listener that sends them an email to the Sugar Plum Cake Shop in Paris and say, "You heard me, Max Kaiser, talk about the cake guillotine on this show," I will do something good for you. So they'll have a record of whoever sent that email first. I don't know if we can actually send you a cake, because I don't think they have the ability to send cakes yet. But you know, put your name in the record, because you may get something. Maybe
It fits with that whole marriage.
A gift certificate for a cake. I'll send you'll get a gift certificate for a guillotine cake if you're the first person to, which will be transferable, if you're the first person to send them an email saying, "You heard on this show Max Kaiser talk about the guillotine cake and celebrate Bastille and the new reign of terror against global bankers."
Well, actually, you know, there's an exhibition, I forget it, I think it might be at Musée d'Orsay, but it's of guillotines. And
I've been there every day.
It was controversial because, of course, the guillotine is considered controversial here in France because of their, let's say, overuse of it. They went a little bit crazy.
It's very humane. Before the guillotine, it was decapitation was a bit of a sloppy business, wasn't it?
Oh, no. Well, you know, during Henry VIII's time, who was very prolific guillotiner, that was kind of reserved just for the aristocracy. The normal people had to be drawn and quartered. So, well, speaking of terror, CSI Financial Terror, Max Kaiser, starring Max Kaiser.
Yeah.
So you were contacted by the House Committee on Homeland Security to discuss the possible financial terrorist attack on May 6th.
Yeah, some bureaucrat in Washington is finally catching up to the last 20 years of Wall Street shenanigans and thinks that they can somehow build a case for some hearings on financial terrorism.
So you're saying it's like, in 10 years' time, suddenly somebody going, hey, I think those buildings in New York City have disappeared.
Yeah, they're
let's investigate.
Weren't there a couple of buildings here? Let's investigate. So you got some bureaucrat in Washington, his name is Beck. He thinks he can score some points with his masters by starting to investigate the financial terrorist crimes, in particular the attack of May 6th, the 1,000-point drop. And my response was, look, you know, whether you know it or not, you're a lackey for Goldman Sachs, and any information I give you, you're going to end up giving to them, and you're just going to make the situation worse. So I'm not going to help you help them destroy the markets. And it's the same argument I use when talking to Greenpeace. When I say to, you know, people know this argument, that Greenpeace goes to Exxon and they say, here are the 10 things you're doing wrong. Exxon buys insurance to cover them against those 10 things. And to pay for the insurance, they lower their operating standards and, in fact, are at risk of doing bad things much worse than when they first talked to Greenpeace to begin with.
Yeah, but the difference between Greenpeace and the House Committee on Homeland Security is a thing called the subpoena.
Yeah.
If they issue a subpoena, so say, hey, you don't want to tell us?
They don't want to issue a subpoena for Max Keiser because because basically, if they let me anywhere near that town, I'm going to end up running America. And people know that. I mean, I'm at a safe distance. My intellectual powers are, how many thousand miles away from Washington, D.C.? And by the time my ideas get to D.C., they're significantly watered down. But if you actually put me in that town, I will rule America. I will rule. Because anyone I meet, I will immediately convert them to my way of thinking. It'll only be a matter of 12 or 24 months before I rule the country. So you don't want me anywhere near that country unless you want to be one of my acolytes, which is fine. But you can do that on the web. I don't need to be schlepping all the way to freaking D.C., you know, I don't need to be going through changes. just sign on to my program, listen to my program, and tell your grandchildren about it. But don't inconvenience me.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, here's another headline from MaxKeiser.com.
Yeah. Oh,
Kramer,
I love that song.
Kramer, even I am outraged at how obvious this casino was rigged. This was the end of the day on Friday, the last 15 minutes, the famous last 15-minute rally, triple-digit rally in the last 15 minutes when the PPT, the plunge protection team, comes in and buys up shares.
Well, here's what I got something to tell you.
Oh, yeah. Tell us.
I've been doing some additional research into market rigging and the financial terrorists that are currently terrorizing the global economy.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the amazing thing, Stacey.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Max Keiser. Tell us.
These computers, Reverend Max. These computers, as of recently, they can read the news.
That's true.
They read the news. You know, computers read the news. They read headlines. They're computer reading.
The algorithms look for certain words and news items in the live stream of Google.
That's right. So you attach those algorithms to the market-making algorithms and the algorithmic trading on Wall Street. So when computers see a headline in the press that says Washington considering reform of banking industry, then that algorithm talks to the algorithm down there in the co-located server next to the New York Stock Exchange run by Goldman Sachs, and it puts in massive sell orders, most of them naked sell orders, high-frequency trading, naked program trading algorithmic sell orders. And they crash the market, and they keep crashing the market until the computer reads something in the press that says Congress is now backing off from reform. Then the computers communicate to the co-located servers on Wall Street, and the reverse happens, and they start buying stocks. So this market manipulation, as it's tied to political agenda, is done completely by computer, and no congressman or Wall Street broker even touches it, intervenes. So they can honestly go before Congress and say, we don't have any idea, we don't engage in market manipulation. Not after they wrote the programs and fed into the computers and it's all automatically done. They don't actually push any buttons. We saw this on May 6th. The computers read that there was reform and they crashed the computer. Then they read that they backed off and they bought back. We saw this last week. There was this new passage of a bill that just went through. It passed, not after another, what was called a repeat of what we saw 2 weeks ago. Then at the end of the Friday, it's passed. It's going to reconciliation. And I predict that if the headlines on Monday are that this bill is stalled in reconciliation, or it's at threat of actually coming out of reconciliation, the computers will communicate to the other computers and we'll see another massive crash. And we already saw another big headline that one of the Congress people said that Ben Bernanke is actively threatening the Congress with market mayhem unless they vote according to
this Congresswoman was said that she was, this is on zerohedge.com, that she was told that if they did not reconfirm Ben Bernanke, the markets would crash. So mm-hmm. How did they know that? How were they threatening that?
Yeah. Okay. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about financial terrorism.
That's now, what that guy at the Homeland Security should look at that and tie right. that in with the May 6th event.
That he should be proactively, investigating and some prosecuting, but he's not. He's just a lackey for Goldman Sachs, fishing for ideas from Max Keiser to algorithmically program traders to scalp markets in new and creative ways, because the people over there at Goldman are basically brain dead. You know, they're fat, lazy, not very talented, just pigs at the trough. They have no original thoughts whatsoever. So they are constantly picking the brains of people like myself to feed, the feather their little Hamptons nests. I say no more.
Speaking of CSI, I did see CSI this week, and I noticed, just to check out the what's happening in the culture of America, and I noticed the psychopathic murderer was called Blankfein.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, the serial killer.
It's in The Mentalist.
Right, right. And the serial killer Red John, they were caught up in a scene where the star was going to get killed by Red John, assisted by some kid who had the last name Blankfein.
Exactly, the Blankfein was inspired by the psychopathic serial killer,
right?
And was acting like him. So the question is, what are they trying to say about Goldman Sachs? Who are they actually acting like? And that's perhaps the global central banker, psychopathic central bankers.
Well, I've often said Charles Manson would be much better central banker than Ben Bernanke.
You said Osama bin Laden.
And Osama bin Laden, he could take over for Trichet. And at least we know what, see, the great thing about...
I think Charles Manson would be better at the ECB.
Why is that?
I don't know. He seems more European in a way that the Europeans would...
I wouldn't want to get him any closer to Polanski, though. I mean, the sparks could fly there.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You might want to keep him in Washington, D.C. There's okay. already been some sparks between those two. And Polanski is in the house arrest in Switzerland.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you're right. Because also Osama bin Laden writes those long-winded diatribes, and the Europeans like that. They like more of an academic.
He's an academic. And he writes the long pieces, and they love that kind of stuff. And then for the Bank of England, I think we could get Squeaky Fromm. Is she still alive?
No, I think she died.
Okay. Well, maybe Mark Oatton, remember him from the Liberal Democrats? He could run the Bank of England in the UK, to emphasize and to strengthen the Lib Dem Tory coalition. And the Bank of Japan will get... Yoko Ono, she might be good as a Bank of Japan.
Screech, she could sing. Screechy sing
every time she's going to not move interest rates. And you could really feel the pain of the 20-year lost 2 decades in Japan every time Yoko Ono opened up her screechy mouth. Oh, by the way, see, we fell into a very pernicious trap, didn't we?
Don't mention the yo-yo word.
We can't mention the yo-yo word on this station. I'll leave it up to you to decide whether to bleep that out. But given recent,
da 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 da. Let's move on.
What else is going on?
Oh,
Oh, by the way.
What?
Did I mention that we've got a deal pending for a Truth About Markets USA show?
No, I don't think you've mentioned that.
Yeah, the Truth About Markets London is so successful, you know, it led to Truth About Markets Christchurch, New Zealand. And now we've got interest for a Truth About Markets USA show distributed by a big distributor in the USA. And that should be up and running in less than 4 weeks. So by this time next month, we should be up and running with our third Truth About Market show, USA.
Hey, did you see Arizona, speaking of the USA, went all Enron-like on Los Angeles? They've threatened to cut off LA's electricity supply if Los Angeles continues with their boycott of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Panarin? Igor Panarin from Russia, didn't he predict that America would break up into five regions? There would be civil war.
Yeah, well, get Shelby Foote out of retirement. He can add another few books to his classic volume about the American Civil War. And then that other guy can make a new documentary on PBS. You know, all those slow-moving stills of, let's say, the leader of Enron or the leader as they broke up the California energy market.
Ken Burns.
Ken Burns documentary, America's Civil War, part 1200. And speaking of America's Civil War, what the heck is going on with this Rand Paul character?
Well, he obviously has no media advisor.
Yeah, he's got his political career lasted about 5 minutes.
Well, it goes with this whole Arizona, you know, threatening to cut off the supply to Los Angeles. Is there seems to be, I guess it's the economic times, the crisis, as we were talking at the top of the show about, you know, Simon Shaman talking about the real genuine building rage amongst mm-hmm. the population is, you know, this is a lot like the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And, well, from World War One to through World War Two. As Jean-Claude Trichet said, that this is he sees a crisis as worse than World War II, post-World War II, that it's like post-World War One, and we know where that led to. But there does seem to be a bit of, to me, it seems, you know, and I am not there, but from the headlines and the news I see and the stuff I watch on Democracy Now!, interviews with people there, it seems like there's a bit of the beginning of scapegoating, and it's mm-hmm. Mexicans and let's get rid of the provision that the Civil Rights Act that forces private companies to you know, serve all customers,
to be including non-discriminatory.
Yeah.
Well, the only way Rand Paul's run is going to work at this point is if he becomes a demagogue.
To people who don't know, Rand Paul is Ron Paul's son, and he's just won the Republican primary in Kentucky to run for Senate in November. And he stated the very next day on several on NPR and then on Rachel Maddow's show on MSNBC that he has a problem with one of the 10 provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and that is the provision that forces private companies, businesses, to have to serve all customers. And this is basically the Jim Crow laws,
mm-hmm.
and where the entire South basically was a no-go zone for black people who weren't allowed to stay in most hotels, motels, go to restaurants, sit at certain counters, travel on certain buses or whatever. So this provision of the Civil Rights Act got rid of that sort of ability for a private business to discriminate and say no blacks allowed, no Irish allowed was often a sign you saw in early America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a political gambit that doesn't make any sense unless you're banking on a race war and banking on becoming a demagogue. Because otherwise, it just makes no sense to put yourself out there and get your head chopped off by Rachel Maddow on CNBC with, obviously, that's what's going to happen if you make an inflammatory comment like that. It makes no political sense, makes no economic sense.
Well, I'm not sure about that. His 538.com, who does a lot of good work on polling and researching polling, it looks like Rand Paul right now is, in some polls, 25 points ahead of the Democratic candidate Jack Conway. So mm-hmm. it looks like he'll probably win Kentucky.
Right. And the thing is that what we're seeing here in America is the emergence of the political freak. Somebody who says the most outrageous thing they can possibly think of, not because they want to be in politics, but because they want to be in front of Larry King talking about their new book.
Yeah, but you had political freaks during that whole time of, you know, the around the Great Depression in America.
Well, you know, if there was a guy when I was growing up named Professor Irwin Corey, I don't know if you remember him.
No.
Or how about Pat Paulson? Pat Paulson ran for president many times.
Never heard of him. Okay,
he was a regular on a show. He was a regular on the Smothers Brothers show, which was a groundbreaking comedy show of the 60s that was tweaking the nose of Nixon and the political establishment. And Pat Paulson, who was a very droll, dry, you know, a comedian, would be running for president. Now, if Pat Paulson ran for president today, he could win a primary and possibly be a senator or a governor, because the freakazoid nation, America, is leaning toward the absolute worst concatenation of the spawn of busted ideas with venal and narcissistic princes. It's not for nothing that the only three people have canceled their appearance on Meet the Press. One was Prince Bandar. We talked about him on this show. Louis Farrakhan and Rand Paul. You know, that's the company he keeps. And that's historically, that's where you got to put this guy. He is a demagogue in waiting. He's just going to say whatever outrageous thing pops into his head at any moment because he's got political Tourette syndrome. And the idea is to sell books, get as far up the slippery ladder of fame in America, and then, you know, jump off with your $50 million. And laugh all the way, you know, to some territory that doesn't have extradition to the U.S. And that's it. I can't take him seriously for one half of 1 second.
Yeah, but a lot of the population might not have memory of what it was like. I don't. I wasn't born before the Civil Rights Act. So.
Well, this is also, I thought, very interesting because there was a discussion about 1964 and what it was like before and after the Civil Rights Act.
This is on Democracy Now!, a professor who wrote a book about this the whole time and the act. And it was actually quite interesting, and it really put it into in a more understandable, you know, something that you could actually feel, a visceral sort of reaction to what it was like to actually, as a black person, to have to travel across the South. And we've seen that in, speaking of Ken Burns, I think it was his jazz series.
Yeah.
Where the very famous black jazz artists had a very, very difficult time traveling across the South, and they had to stay in local families' homes and things like that because they weren't allowed to stay in any hotels.
You know, the very fact that this whole period of history is being discussed in these kind of placid tones is freaking ridiculous, because if you look in the history books, you see lynchings of dead black people swinging from trees. And that's not to be taken lightly. And Rand Paul, to even go within a 50-mile barge pole of anything having to do with the strange fruit, as Billie Holiday called it, qualifies him as a demagogue in waiting and as basically political dog feces that I wouldn't scrape off my shoe. You know, he should be nowhere near this issue in any way, shape, or form, because anyone, you know, it's absurd. And the fact that it's being talked about in this, you know, abstract context as if before and after the Civil Rights Movement, why don't you talk about before and after the Revolutionary War of 1776 and to point out the fact that this guy, Rand Paul, would be a redcoat. He'd be in bed with the British Empire. He's not in any way, shape, or form to be considered sympathetic to anything America stands for. He's a lowlife and a punk, and anything that I can do to stop his political career, I won't be bothered with, because I've got better stuff to do with my time, because the whole freaking system is broken, and forget him, because within 6 months, he's going to have his book out called, you know, Rand McDuty, Howdy Duty, Rand on My Shoe, whatever. I can't even think of the...
What? Well, yeah, so that's the discussion going on in America, but it's going on all over the place, really, right now. And well, you know, there's scapegoating all over the place because There's a giant financial crisis, and it's getting worse, as we see.
You remember George Wallace?
Kind of.
George Wallace, he was a politician down south who ran against the Jim Crow laws. Okay, Rand Paul is the reincarnation of George Wallace. Is that what America wants? Hello?
You looked like you were going to continue.
Does America really want a southern bigot, you know, down there? Yeah, lynching, hanging black people up? Is that what they want? Well, you know, it's unfortunately, it's a trend which is stoked by economic calamity, which is all coming unglued because of all the thieving we've seen on Wall Street. So, and that's not going to stop anytime soon.
Well, it just, I don't understand it. I mean, I understand the whole thing that, you know, get government off my back and all that kind of stuff. But it seems very strange to, because, okay, one supermarket, for example, doesn't want to serve black people or Mexican people or white people. And then maybe all of the, what if the whole entire town or city decides, every single supermarket doesn't want to serve food to this certain specific brand of people, or women, or to men, or to, you know, dwarves, or anything, you know, that group of people can just be excluded from the interacting with the rest of society.
Yeah, well, those folks, those rappers, you know, who've been so actively pushing back against the man.
They have? Yeah, it really looks like it from their penthouses and Fifth Avenue. And 50 Cent lived in Connecticut, not too far from my mother's house, in this giant mansion. And
well, the 50 Cent's been hit by deflation, too. He's changing his name to 25 Cent.
Uh-huh. 20 Cent.
20 Cent. You know, he's got a problem with deflation as well.
Yeah, I don't think so for some reason. But that's it for this week's Truth About Markets.
The only one who's got any money is Tiger Woods' ex-wife.
She's not ex yet.
$750 million she's going for. Ka-ching. That's a big one.
Okay.
Hey, man. I guess that's going to do it for this edition of Truth About Markets London. Until next time, Max and Stacey saying bye, y'all.